Hello, welcome to episode 72 of the Extra Sequential podcast about comics, graphic novels, and manga. My name's Mladen.
My name is Chris, and we are talking about some of our faves of this year. As we cast our mind, we cast our eyes and the eyes of our mind back 12 months, and what a heady 12 months it's been. Yes, you heard me. Heady.
So much energy. You could say the last year of podcasts has been leading up to this moment. This crystal clear moment defines our entire taste for the whole year.
We have been dancing for the last 12 months in this podcast, to and fro, stepping on each other's toes, and now is the moment
where
one of us dips the other one and perhaps puts a rose in their mouth.
Oh, I'm so glad you didn't go for some worse analogy than that. How are you? How you been?
I am good. I'm not too bad at all. I'm just looking forward to the Christmas holidays. I've done all my shopping. I've planned and completed that well in advance. Mm-hmm. And I'm just ready for some good time off and sleeping in.
Every day is Christmas for me, so there's no difference. Let's get into the comic book news, shall we?
We shall.
Now, there's been a couple of trailers this week, and two of note, I suppose. Now, the first we'll just mention quickly. The Hobbit trailer, I think, was released today.
Today, Amir, hours ago.
So I'm excited by this trailer, but it's another year's wait.
I'm less excited as I was hoping to be. This is Peter Jackson, who's still directing this, as he did with The Lord of the Rings. Guillermo del Toro was attached for a couple of years and then kind of took far too long. So this is the two films that were being filmed back-to-back, I believe, and kind of the prequel to The Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. Ian McKellen, Cate Blanchett, Orlando Bloom, and Saruman, what's his name, Christopher Lee, still in a few. But mostly it's all new cast. But, yeah, Martin Freeman,
From The Office.
He still seems to be playing The Office character. And he just doesn't seem to be he's got the same mannerisms as Tim from The Office.
Oh, does he? Well, I'll let the film convince me. And seeing as it's a year until they even wrapped up on it, I'm impressed that they've done some special effects work already, you know, a taste. I'm sure there'll be a lot more cool stuff to be seen very soon. The other trailer we both got to see was the Dark Knight Rises trailer, which is the third Batman film.
Correct.
From Mr. C. Nolan.
Yes, set 8 years after the last film, back-breaking Bane. Mm-hmm. Looks quite different from his comic counterpart, less of the Mexican wrestling mask with a little singlet. Mm-hmm. And played by Tom Hardy, so, yeah, Michael Caine and all those.
And Anne Hathaway looking stupid.
and Catwoman. All the dialogue and stuff seems very... Yeah. And there's been a prologue, an IMAX film, I think 7 or 8 minute prologue of Bane coming in this hijinks sky.
Hijinks, which, it's you. It's like Dennis the Menace in your estimation.
Which, if you're lucky enough and you go to see Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, which I just saw and is awesome, in an IMAX cinema, which we don't have in Perth, mm-hmm. but if you do, then you'll see this prologue where Bane gets up to... Mm.
And apparently there's three different prologues. So when they're trying to encourage people to see Mission Impossible more than three times, I assume, because you don't know which one you're going to get. It's a clever way to drum up some more viewership for the ticket sales for that film. But brief thoughts on this. I mean, it looks suitably depressing, like all the other Chris Nolan movies. But whereas, say, for me, the action aspects, I don't really care. I'm intrigued by the idea that they're doing this whole wealth inequality plot through the lens of a superhero story, especially with a character who couldn't exist without his extreme wealth and privilege. And it's a nice to see that instead of just a subtext, the whole plot is being driven by Bane and Catwoman's quest for the underpaid masses, it seems.
And it'll be interesting to see Bane, who's obviously the interviews with Tom Hardy, the actor who plays Bane, and co-writer director Christopher Nolan, who's saying that Bane is actually a physical match for Batman. So we've only had Batman kind of taken on thugs and stuff. So yeah, I'm looking forward to a big brawl between these two titans.
Punching thugs and dogs, from what I remember. In other filmy news, the gentleman who uploaded the early cut of X-Men Origins Wolverine to the net a month before the film was to debut has been sentenced to a year in federal prison. 49-year-old Gilberto Sanchez. His pirated work print was downloaded at least 4 million times, which they predict translates to 28.7 million in lost ticket sales if the downloaders then chose to not see it in theatres. As a lot of us know, the leaked version was missing special effects and it wasn't finished in editing, and they were obviously worried about bad word of mouth, which there was a lot. But guess what? Wolverine still went on to have one of the largest opening day sales of any film.
No justice.
Yes, and it made $370 million worldwide, despite the fact it's a piece of shit.
I wouldn't put it quite like that, but yes.
So Sanchez actually has prior convictions for similar offences. It's not the first time he's uploaded pirated films. He's been doing it for 4 to 5 years, apparently. So I guess they finally had enough with him. So, yeah, a year in federal prison and his internet rights are being limited for the rest of his life, from what I understand, if that's a thing.
Well, hopefully, if he's listening to this, he's not too embarrassed.
Apparently, the all reports say he was not remorseful. So, I don't know how to react to this, but it sets a precedent, that's for sure. So,
that's a good thing, I think.
Well, I'm hoping it doesn't mean that people who've, you know, watched films on YouTube eventually will be tried and court-martialed or whatever. I reckon we're ready to get into our feature topic. Yes?
Sure.
Let's do this. They're about to begin. Chris?
Yes. Hello. What do you want? Who are
don't
you?
Don't scream in my ear.
I'm sorry. Should I scream in your nostrils?
Enough of the banter. This week, we are covering our favourite comics of 2011, and I had a lot of fun preparing for this episode, looking back over things I've read, trying to work out, you know, what makes the cut. But if you're listening to us for the first time, this might be a good litmus test for how much you'll agree with us, and I'm interested to see whether you and I agree on a few items in here,
yes,
Chris.
Yes, we have not disclosed. The envelopes remain unbroken, but I think you had a lot more fun preparing the show than I did because we've got the time, and I was like forcing myself to read all these books. You know, we talked a couple of weeks ago about the unread stack.
Yeah,
the stuff that's just been gathering dust on our shores for far too long, and a lot of mine have been original graphic novels from this year. So I was like reading them on the bus, taking them to work, reading them at lunchtime, reading them when I got. So I was just like force reading myself comics, and then goes, "Is this good? Is this better? What's better?" And I was like, and then I didn't think about it too much.
Well, I'm glad to know this means nothing to you.
I wouldn't say that.
I'm ready to get into it if you are, Chris.
I'm ready.
Now, the first category we have is collected editions of classic material. And this is just a nice reprint, basically. Yeah. What is your choice this year, Chris?
Well, this is a theoretical choice.
You haven't read it, have you?
No.
Go on.
But I wanted to give a shout out to IDW's Artists Editions, which started this year in July. They announced them at San Diego Comic Con. So basically what these are huge coffee table books for the artist slash collector rather than the reader.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been flying off the shelves, rather expensive, but deluxe tome. So they've published Walt Simonson's Thor, Wally Wood's EC Stories, and Dave Stevens' The Rocketeer. So basically their aim is to go through the catalogue and these and republish in the original art. So what they do is they scan all the original art boards. For those who don't know how comics are made, the arts are actually drawn on the, you know, like 3 or 4 times bigger than what the comic.
So to clear this up, the artist doesn't actually draw in every single comic?
No, well, that is true. So they scan from the original art in colour, so you still even so the obviously art is black and white, so you see the white out corrections, you see the blue pencil, you see the margin notes, the yellowed pages, if there's any coffee stains. So it's like it's 15 by 22 inches. There's about 150 pages for each volume, and they retail for about $100 US each. So they're beautifully well presented. And I mean, obviously they're like trade paperbacks reprinting I mean, yeah, Will Simonson's Thor was done in the 80s. Wally Wood's EC stories, horror and sci-fi stories, were done in the 50s and 60s, I guess. Dave Stevens' The Rocketeers was done in the 70s and 80s. And then they have Will Eisner's The Spirit and John Romita's The Amazing Spider-Man, which will both be out next year. So I want to give a shout-out because that's kind of the – rather than just a trade paperback, but these are, like, pretty high-end luxe. So if you've got fans that people in your family that want to they really enjoy art and seeing the kind of process, these are definitely the books to get them, I would say.
Excellent. I've gone for a more maybe a more typical selection, and for a couple of reasons, and I'll explain myself here. I've picked Donald Duck Lost in the Andes. For a couple of main reasons, I guess. One is that the way it's been republished, unlike a lot of other Fantagraphics collections of, say, material from the 40s and before, this one has been made in a format which is suitable for kids, as in it's a hardback, but it's not a precious art object in itself. It's a readable book, and as well as it, I felt like they've balanced one, all these essays and additional material, and also the all ages aspects of it, trying to at least, you know, a kid could read this, you know, that's the great thing, and that's the intended audience. I'm not a huge fan of this whole concept of elevating children's comics to a level of high art. You can find aspects of it, but, you know, at their basis, it's for kids, and if it's not in the hands of kids, it's almost a little bit perverse. So this sidesteps that nicely, and it's a beautiful book, beautiful stories by Carl Barks, and the other great thing is that they're publishing the stories as they originally appear, including all the slight, what would be now considered, I guess, risky material in terms of racial stereotyping and so forth. So it's nice to see that they haven't been forced to excise any of that material. So for me, yeah, it's Donald Duck Lost in the Andes. There you go.
Which we devoted a whole episode to a while ago.
That's right.
I agree with that one. It was a pretty good reprint. And, for me, it was a good eye-opener as well to that classic material.
And I'm keen to check out these art books because I hear very good – the ones you're talking about, I hear very good things about, especially from the point of view of someone – you've never seen the art like that, you know, as they –
No, that kind of unpolished. I mean, it still looks amazing, obviously, because he's a professional artist. But, yeah, that kind of behind-the-scenes unpolished art.
We feel like you're getting to know them almost and how they work.
Yeah.
In a way. Next category we have here is a film adaptation of a comic work.
Yes.
Now – I'll name my selection here. At first, I was kind of racking my brains, but really there's only one film that for me was even worth it, and that is the Japanese adaptation of Gantz.
Okay, yes.
Now, there's been an anime series already, but this is a pair of live-action films, and I'm going to talk about the first. They both came out in 2011, and this is a Japanese manga where the recently dead, they're mysteriously transported alive and well to this mysterious space room with this mysterious black orb. I'm using that word a lot. And they're forced to assassinate aliens who are living and hiding on Earth to get points. It's kind of this weird blend of violent escapism with terrifying horror. And the film captures the eerie tone of the manga. It tones down a lot of the more grating narrative problems, and it cleverly excises the more shall we say, gratuitous elements. So okay. It's a perfect example for me of how to condense a fairly long work and how to combine minor characters into, you know, single characters and so forth to streamline a story in a way that's not alienating the core audience but is also keeping a new audience. And it works really well in that regard. Great action set piece, like really amazing action set pieces, I should say. Great special effects and sound design. If anyone's read Gantz, they absolutely nailed the transportation effect. It looks amazing. And rather than as in the anime where it's drawn out and over dramatic, they turn it kind of into a horror movie, and they play up the superpowered aspect later. So I would thoroughly recommend pick up Gantz. I'm fairly certain Madman will be putting out Blu-ray and DVD releases of that. It's well worth it. Great action movie.
Cool. I actually want to see those two.
Well worth it. I think you'd really enjoy them, actually. You love your action films, and this delivers in spades.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I did want to are we going to talk about our kind of – we'll talk about our kind of runners-up later, I guess, won't we?
Yeah.
But I did want to know, yeah, Captain America was the first one for me, directed by Joe Johnston, who directed Rocketeer. It was better than Thor. It was more grounded, obviously. It opened in July of this year, the DVD and Blu-ray out now. Obviously, this is created, Captain America's created by Jack Kirby and Joe Simon. Joe Simon, who recently just died, as did Jerry Robinson, in the span of a few days of each other. Jerry Robinson was instrumental in the early issues of Batman, a co-creator of the Joker, I believe. So these two guys, I think they were both in there. Late 80s, 90s, so kind of legends of the sequential art and the history there. But anyway, Captain America was a great film, and starring Chris Evans, obviously, is the scrawny guy who then goes into the super soldier serum and becomes America's most patriotic hero. Setting World War II was a really a smart move, I think. And for those of you who have seen the film, you'll realise that he comes into the present day and sees the kind of formation of the Avengers. The Avengers film is out next year. But it was kind of like an old star, you know, one of the original Star Wars films where it's got kind of that adventure, a bit of romance. It was quite funny. Tommy Lee Jones is one of the colonels. It's quite funny. It's got enough Easter eggs. There's all these Marvel films in there. Bucky Barnes is in there. The Howling Commandos are in there. Red Skull is the main bad guy, played by Hugo Weaving. There's not much of a fight between those two characters, but nevertheless, it's got kind of good World War II heroics. Tony Stark's dad is in there as well, Howard Stark. So, yeah, this is a really good film. It's been in the works since 1997, but Joe Simon actually was suing Marvel for quite a while over the rights of Captain America. So eventually got made. Have you seen this?
No, I have not seen this, no.
Okay. It's one of those kind of good, wholesome, swashbuckling films, you know, even though it's set in World War II, there's no Nazis or bloodshed. I really enjoyed it. So I haven't seen the DVD or Blu-ray, but apparently it's got quite a lot of good extras. So I'm looking forward to, catching that out, hopefully.
A fine selection, and I suggest everyone go to your video store and get those films out because, it's a fun watch and evening, a night in with your pals, and they're both great action films.
Yes.
Let's do Australian comic.
Okay, you go first.
Okay. My choice for me, I didn't really have to think too hard because there's only one Australian comic that I've read this year that really was connected with me and kind of made me go, ooh, and that's Bobby Enns' Digested.
Oh, yes, I thought you might mention that, yes.
Yes, and this is his very, I guess, idiosyncratic comic, which has come out through Gestalt, and it doesn't look like other comics, and it's in a small square bound format. They're quite small issues, and I think there's only about six issues out so far. But Bobby has this very unique and very, I guess, an intense vision of the world and how people interact with each other. And what he really nails is he has a really effortless mastery of dialogue and to make it humorous, to get the interplay of a conversation. There's really strong pacing, like layered stories, and for me, I find them very memorable. And the range of stories in here, from kind of light and fun to heavy and symbolic, it's a comic that's, if you are curious about Australian comics, I think this is a vision that's unique. There are other, I guess, American comics have their own autobiographical style. This isn't like that. Wonderfully drawn, very cartooned. I'd thoroughly recommend Bobby Enns' Digested.
It is very entertaining. It's something you could give to someone who's never read comics before. It's got great little short stories that anyone can enjoy. Speaking of Gestalt, they've had quite a productive year this year. So they've published Torn, which is a great werewolf tale and a kind of Wild West supernatural. Eldritch Kids, both great original graphic novels that have been released this year. And I did want to give a shout out as well to the Zorro series that
is
from Silver Fox Comics. You might see it in newspaper, you might see it in newsagent near you. And we're very supportive of Australian, new Australian talent. So it's good to see that. But yeah, I want to mention The Deep Here Be Dragons, to give it its full name. We actually talked about it a couple of times on the show before, so I won't talk about it too much. Written by Tom Taylor, who does Star Wars Invasion, is currently doing DC Universe Online Legends for DC Comics, and first time, I believe, artist James Brower. And the kind of Pixar leanings, I guess, and resemblance of the art is a keen one, but it basically focuses on multicultural Necton family and their high-tech sub, the Aranaks, and basically they go to Greenland for some strange undersea, strange sightings of undersea creatures. And, but yeah, it's very well written. Tom Taylor is a great writer. It's one of those all-ages books, I guess. So there's going to be another one coming. I don't know when, but it was announced a few months ago that there will be a second one. But, yeah, that's an original graphic novel, full colour, wonderful art, quite funny in places, great character work as well. That's called The Deep, Here Be Dragons, and I really enjoyed that. I'm not much of an all-ages reader, but, yeah, that one kind of, it was almost like a Saturday morning cartoon in the 80s that I kind of grew up watching. It kind of reminded me of one of those, like Bionic 6 or something like that. So, yeah, I enjoyed it.
I remember when we reviewed that on the show, I was probably harsher on it than I...
Don't apologize.
Looking back on it, I'm like, you know, this is all right. I think I was just in a totally wrong mood. yeah.
You're a very moody young man.
I know, right? You just have to be in the right mood for certain kind of things. Isn't that always the way? The next category is... foreign material in English. Now, the reason we've separated this is basically because manga and European comics usually take a couple of years to get translated into English. So when we're reading them and it seems like a brand new book, it's probably from around 2006 or so forth. So it's worth making that small distinction. I'm curious to hear what you picked for this category, Chris.
Well, it's pretty easy because I've pretty only read one, really. And that is from Humanoids. So Humanoids Publishing have been around in France for years and years. That's only, I believe, this year they've actually started publishing their stuff in English with any regularity as part of and being in the Diamond Previews catalogue that comes out every month. So this is the first time where it's actually been easier for kind of English-speaking audiences to actually order the stuff. So I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. It's pretty curious. So when I picked it up, I was pretty impressed by, you know, like, what should I order? Because they've always got, you know, OGNs and trades in every month, and I never heard of any of them before. Actually, I did read this year as well Studio GG or GG Studio, which is, I think, an Italian publishing company. Their stuff has also been published in English for the first time this year, such as The Skeleton Story and a few others that I've read, which haven't been too bad. But this one, it's a hardcover trade, and it's called The Zombies That Ate the World, Book 1, Bring Me Back My Head! Written by Jerry Frisson and art by Guy Davis, who's done artwork for The Marquis, Inferno, and BPRD, Hellboy kind of spin-off series. So this was... it's kind of like a, I don't know if you're familiar with the World War Z novel that kind of looks at the zombie apocalypse in little short snippets of stories. It's realistic and it's being turned into a film. This is kind of like that, but the funny flip side. So there's like a bigger picture intertwined with shorter 12 or so page stories. Originally published as a kind of monthly format in 2003 in the French Metal Helmet. There have been four albums so far, with a fifth one in the works. It's set in 2064 in LA, and zombies have been around for a while now, but they're kind of tolerated and integrated in society, and so they're kind of respected. And, you know, in the age of political correctness gone mad, they're kind of allowed, you know, some of them speak, and so they're kind of allowed to work and that kind of stuff. So I wasn't sure what to...
Work dead-end jobs?
So I wasn't sure what to expect because I thought, oh, zombies again. But was that, you know, so this is one of those things which I haven't done in a while, but I just ordered it on a whim. And I was very impressed, Maladdin. I was very impressed. So it's quite funny. So basically it focuses on there's this zombie catcher, Carl, and his sister Maggie. The first story, they're basically hired to evict this guy's father-in-law because he keeps trying to while this guy's trying to make love to his wife, the father-in-law keeps zombieifying into the bed and wants to join it, wants to have a bit of a threesome. So he gets the son-in-law has.
Is this
had
from
enough.
The closed section of previews? What is this?
No, it's not. It's not very sexual. There's some mild nudity. There's the old nipple slip here and there, but it's. But and then the wife dies of shock. But the zombie catcher kind of falls in love with her and kidnaps her because he falls in love with his zombie girl. It's not as perverse as I'm describing it. The next story, they're hired by this kind of fat mogul, Otto Maddox. He's basically this rich guy who collects zombie girls for pleasure. So he basically has this whole zombie harem of like zombie celebrities. So he'll have like the zombie Paris Hilton, and you know he'll have a lot of zombie actresses and models, supermodels, and he basically collects them to do his bidding. And he wants to dig up one of the finest to get away from his collection. Is this classic screen actress who only ever appeared in zombie films, and obviously eventually died. She became a zombie. And then there's a story which, even though it doesn't say it, but you know it's the zombie Ramones. And they break into a house. The husband, it's a lot of family issues here, but basically the mother-in-law has been staying at this family's home, and the husband just doesn't like her. So he distracts the wife. Quick, lock the back door. And then all of a sudden he throws the mother-in-law at the zombie Ramones, and then the wife comes back. Oh, no, they've taken your mother. Oh, what did you say? You know. And then there's a story of a scientist who resurrects like a dead brain for some kind of Nazi-like cult, etc. So a lot of the stories are, you know, like a dozen pages thereabouts. So it's quite an easy read, and it's kind of, I guess, if you like The Goon, I know I mentioned that a lot, but it is quite a funny comic. If you like Eric Powers' The Goon, this is the same kind of style, very funny. And if I see the other trades, I'll pick this up cheap. I'm glad that this has been apparently Devil's Due published. I think the first volume about 3 years ago. But this is the first time. Hopefully this will be published regularly. So that's from Humanoids Publishing, The Zombies That Ate the World. If you like horror comedy, this is the one for you.
It sounds a bit like Dylan Dog, which is another Italian comic. Similar sense of humour, it sounds like.
Yeah, The Zombies That Ate the World. What have you got?
For me, I was tossing up between a couple. I recently enjoyed the Axe manga anthology, which finally published in English, the long-running alternative manga comic. But I enjoyed that, but it didn't quite do it for me. I wanted to maybe give it to 20th Century Boys, but I gave Naoki Urasawa a prize last year for Billy Bats. I'm like, nah, he's had enough kudos from me. And I thought, oh, perfect, The Drops of God. Now, I talked about this last week. And this series wrapped up, I think, in 2006, so it's only just seeing English translation. It's been a huge hit in France. It's already been published there, and it's a New York Times best-selling right now. And it's by Tadashi Agi, which is actually the pseudonym of the creative team of brother and sister Yuko and Shin Kibayashi, and artwork by Shu Okimoto. And what it's about is there's this estranged son of a famous wine critic, and he's informed on his father's death that in order to inherit his father's fortune, he has to pass these series of complex wine tasting challenges, which includes tasting 13 wines, 12 of which are called the apostles, and then there's the final drops of God. So he's getting the thing here. But the twist is he has no interest in wine himself. He's never even tasted it. But his father manipulated him from a young age by having him lick leather belts and wood chips and things in order to develop his palate and tasting skill. So he has to kind of use his inheritability to beat the father's adopted son, who's a snooty wine critic. So along the way, he's helped by a friendly cast. And the great thing about this is, as he's learning about the wine, so is the reader. And the way the comic describes flavors is very striking. I talked about last week how they'll suddenly flash to the characters magically transported in his mind to being on stage with Queen. Wine reminds him of that kind of rock music, or suddenly being transported to a field of flowers, or, yeah, like the way they describe flavors. And all the wines which appear in the book are real, 100% real. And it's a big part in the recent wine interest boom in Japan and Korea. They think it's probably to do with this manga, really. Yes. So changing cultures. This manga has influenced an entire culture, and I like that it's a hit in France, and it's such a hilariously snooty book. You'll get a lot of laughs. The story's fun and interesting, and it moves along at a pretty good pace. I would recommend it.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's move on into new or breakout talent. Now, this is a vaguely defined topic at best, but kind of, they have, in my criteria, they have to be a relatively new artist or writer. And for me, they had to make me kind of stop in my tracks and go, who is this? So,
I was, I guess, the obvious one. Well, this is my second pick, I guess, because I haven't read much of his work, but that's writer Nick Spencer. He's been quite prolific this year. He's I guess, got known through Morning Glory's image series about set a bunch of students kind of lost in a boarding school, if you will, or a bunch of kids all with the same birthday. That debuted last year and has been going from Glory to Glory. Morning Glory's also produced Infinite Vacation. And then basically, as happens, Marvel noticed him and he wrote Iron Man, Secret Avengers. He's doing the new Ultimate Comics X-Men next year, Thunder Agents for DC. So he's been pretty prolific. So I guess it's been a breakout year for him. Mm-hmm. But I did want to mention my pick would be Mike Huddleston. He's been around for a while. He's a wonderful artist who's done a fair few Batman titles kind of on and off. He hasn't really had an ongoing series. He did The Coffin. A book which has been in my stack for a while, but he's got this kind of wonderful, very evocative, unpredictable style that seems to change whatever book he's on. So he's currently hit it this year with Image Comics, written by Joe Casey, I believe, Butcher Baker, The Righteous Maker, which is a very fanciful and quite crude, rude out there, a lot of profanity, superhero parody. It is also on The Strain, which is the new horror comic from Dark Horse Comics, based on the series of Vampire as a Virus books by Chuck Hogan and Guillermo del Toro. And he also did Homeland Directive, which I think we both read and devoted an issue to a few months ago as well. So he's a wonderful artist. If you just Google his name, you'll see it. It's very hard for me to describe it. But he's kind of pop art and LSD acid trip when he needs to be, and he can bring it a bit more closer when he's doing work like The Strain, which is a great horror new series from Dark Horse Comics. And Homeland Directive, I think we can both agree, was a pretty visually arresting book. The kind of stuff he does with colour and black and white, he kind of mixes it up and makes each page look interesting. He's not your standard typical artist approach when he does his work. So, my thumbs up would go to Mike Huddleston.
That's a good choice. For me, I was Sean Murphy to me is new because I'm only really familiarizing myself with his work recently, and that's through Joe the Barbarian. But I know he's worked on Hellblazer, and that was, I think, last year. So he's been involved for a few years. So I'm like, okay, maybe not Sean Murphy, even though his work is awesome. For me, the artist I sort of really went to this year going, wow, who is this guy, is a young artist who's only just started out called Ian Bertram.
Okay.
Now,
familiar with him?
Now, this lad, he's yet to have a full-length comic published. He's first appeared in the Ink magazine anthology from New York's School's Visual from New York School of Visual Arts, in which he's actually a junior. But his style is a mix between, say, Peter Chung of Aeon Flux and Mobius, with a bit of Jeff Darrow thrown in there, that hyper detailed. And his website, which is called Techno Hell, samples a lot of his comics there. He's got one, his comic for his thesis is called 1001, and that's it was self-published with masking tape and staples and photocopied. And it's a 17-page science fiction story, and it's based on part of Arabian Nights, but the imagery and imagination and like this control of composition and thought that's gone into it is, for me, so striking that it kind of warrants a mention. He and writer-artist Corey Levine are currently putting the finishing touches on a book called Bowery Boys, which is set in the mid-19th century Lower Manhattan. And I'm looking forward to that when they're shopping around for a publisher. And based on the work, I don't think they'll find too much trouble. And for those who are interested, he's got some sample pages of an X-Men comic up on his website. So for me, It's not even a breakout. It's like barely cracked the shell that he's trying to escape out of. But I'm willing to put my ass on the line and say I think we'll be seeing more of this guy. I thought we'd just check in on a couple of the guys we picked last year. I know Tom Taylor's storming away. So much work on huge, obviously, Star Wars projects. Still constantly going on, and a million and one Gestalt things, it seems. Great writer, and The Deep you mentioned. So he's kind of fulfilled his promise of last year.
Yes.
And Raphael Grampa, I think, was a pick I made last year. Yep. And he went on to illustrate probably the most memorable story from Marvel's Strange Tales 2.
Yes.
If you remember that one, the dialogue where he's like
the
Wolverine one. Yeah, he's like a wrestler. And that's the story that everyone noticed. And he's worked on quite a few covers for Marvel and Vertigo, in the last year or so. So hopefully we'll see more sequential work from him.
Yeah, so definitely. That'd be awesome.
Yeah. All right. Now let's move into, continuing series. Now this, to qualify, the series had to have been introduced before 2011 but continued into this year. So, Chris, what is your selection?
Well, yes, I'm going to kind of it's a DC series. It's Green Lantern.
Okay.
Now, because obviously we knew DC kind of rejigged in September all of their series and started their superhero series from number one.
Yeah.
So, technically, it doesn't fall into the parameter, but technically it kind of does.
I'd say it does. It's still the same series. It's just a new counting.
Yeah, same creator, same series. So, Green Lantern and Batman titles were the only ones that kind of largely remained unscathed, mm-hmm. all the others did. So, we know that at the end of the Brightest Day miniseries, I think it ended at the start this year, ended with Hal Jordan, who was played by Ryan Reynolds in the widely disregarded film, right, let's say, having his rim taken away, and then bad guy, pointy head, moustachioid, purple-skinned Sinestro having a green ring again after being in the yellow ring Sinestro Corps for many, many months. So basically when this series kicks off, this is written by Geoff Johns, who has basically guided the Green Lantern and Flash characters back into prominence at DC over the last couple of years, with art by Doug Mankey, who I followed since his Justice League days, and he's just a great artist.
Great artist, yeah.
Not very predictable, very consistent and reliable.
Mm.
So it's the only, since September, so we've only had, what, three or four issues out since then, but this has just been a fantastic series, and pretty much when September hit, I dropped pretty much all of my DC books except Green Lantern and Batman and Robin, pretty much. So, so Hal Jordan is ringless, and it's interesting to see this guy. He's kind of Geoff Johns handled him very well. He's got no ring, and he's kind of just bumming around, doesn't know what to do with his life. He's angry at the world, angry at the Guardians for taking him away because he's so rebellious. And Sinestro is now the hero. He's got a Green Lantern ring, and Sinestro doesn't want a Green Lantern ring either. So these two characters have just had a sudden shift in who they are. And it's been interesting to follow their personalities. Sinestro eventually creates a kind of temporary Green Lantern ring with limitations on it for Hal, and he's happy again, and the two of them, former enemies, pair up and kind of take down Sinestro's former allies in the Sinestro Corps. So it's kind of reminded me of Breaking Bad, how you kind of see the first two seasons, but you see these kind of characters working kind of well together, even though they're kind of
nothing in common, and they
quite different characters. And then you see, obviously, each episode they're kind of broken down, and they're making choices that surprise them. The kind of Green Lantern is the Breaking Bad of the superhero universe.
You know, I've never heard Green Lantern compared to Breaking Bad. It's an interesting analogy, though. that makes me more curious about this comic than anything I've heard so far. Not from you, but from other people. I'm like, that's an interesting comparison. Okay.
Yeah,
you've piqued my interest.
Apt.
Oh, very apt. Excellent. You know, for me this year, I picked nothing. Now, I've been reading only a couple of comics that have continued. I tend to read mostly original graphic novels, web comics, one shots or miniseries. Yeah. And for me, in terms of continuing series, I really only kept up with DMZ and Northlanders. So if I had to give it to anything, probably Northlanders, but it's kind of a reluctant choice because that series is getting cancelled and I'm bummed about that. So I abstain. I abstain from voting.
You're like Switzerland.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
But to make up for it, I have picked in our next category, new ongoing series or miniseries introduced in 2011. So,
okay.
Yeah. I've picked, I'll briefly mention a couple which almost made the cut. I did enjoy Who is Jake Ellis this year, although I did feel it had a very rushed conclusion, and they kind of rushed a bit of the characterization stuff towards the end. But from what I understand, that series is continuing?
Yeah, I'm still, I was going to mention that one as well. This is the Image series that started, I think, in January, so five issues came out. There was a bit of a gap between the fourth and the fifth issue. Written by Nathan Edmondson, who's the Activity is actually out this week, also from Image Comics, with great art by Tonki Zonchik. We've mentioned it before, kind of spy caper with a twist. And that was kind of wives kind of toss up between that one and the one I'll mention later. But yes, okay. I believe that it's actually supposed to continue on. But he's been, Nathan Edmondson has been quite busy with a lot of other work,
okay.
Mainly for DC doing their new Grifter series that's launched in September. So hopefully he can get back to that because, yeah, I think there's still more stories to be told in the Jake Ellis world.
And I need to find out. Who is Jake Ellis? The question wasn't quite answered, and looking forward to learning more about this character. And we should mention the series is basically about this spy who has this this person who only he can see, and he guides him step by step through dangerous situations like pick up the gun, duck now, okay, dodge left now, swing wildly, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see how that layers from what the criminals are seeing to how he's having these conversations in his head. It's a very interesting comic, kind of David Mazzucchelli-esque art, I guess. Very cool. That's it. But it's neither of our best.
The trade paperback has just been released for those 5 issues, so grab it if you can.
Check it out. For me, my favourite, one I enjoyed the most, and for me that was just the criteria which it has to meet, is Blue Estate from Image Comics. Now, this is a crime drama set in the glamorous and seedy world of modern LA, and it's got a very vast array of characters and quite a few subplots and these intertwining stories involving Russian mobsters, corrupt film stars and their wives who are plotting murders, useless private investigators caught in the middle, drug traffickers, you name it. It's kind of a melting pot of all these different ideas. And people have described it as Tarantino-esque, like Pulp Fiction. I sort of feel it's a little bit closer to Snatch in terms of pacing and tone and energy. And it's written by Victor Kalvachev and Andrew Osborne. It has art by Toby Cypress, Nathan Fox, and Victor Kalvachev again. Kalvachev, I should say. And it's so energetic, more than anything I've read in a very long time. Kind of joyful, colourful, twisty-turny plots. Lots of room for multiple character threads. They all gel nicely together. And it reminds me a little bit of the work, maybe manga fans will know who this is. It reminds me a little bit of the work of Philippe Smith, but more artful and creative. But yeah, if you're a fan of wonderfully expressive and, character sort of driven work, like lots of faces in terms, like the bodies express them. It's very human. It's a hard thing to describe, but it's also very cartoony and it's almost animated on the page. It really pops. And for me, that's enough to make me go, whoa, this is something else. So yeah, Blue Estate from Image Comics, thoroughly recommended. And the first trade of that has been released and it's ongoing. So check it out.
Who is Jake Ellis does certainly win it for me, but I did want to mention also from Dynamite Entertainment, Kevin Smith's Bionic Man, launched in August, and it's based on his 1998 unproduced screenplay, much like Dynamite's The Green Hornet series was also based on a screenplay by the same creators, by Jonathan Lau, covers by Alex Ross. They're releasing a Bionic Woman spin-off series next year. But if you know the $6 Million Man TV series, you'll be familiar with the story. Colonel Steve Austin, the experimental plane crashes, and then, you know, we can rebuild him stronger, faster, et cetera. So it's actually a wonderful story, a great art. And when it was first kind of introduced, then we know that there's another cyborg already out there murdering scientists, as there's a bit of menace.
Mm-hmm.
And the first few issues after his accident, Steve initially, he basically just wants to die. He's basically, you know, he's got no limbs, and, you know, they even had to amputate his other good arm for balance, and his new cyborg limbs are quite heavy. So it actually takes until the fourth issue until Steve accepts that he can actually still have a normal life and serve his country. The fifth issue, has just been released, and that's quite an interesting one. He actually poses as a Russian scientist on his first mission as a new, more than $6 million man. And the language, the Russian language, is actually just uploaded into his brain. There's an interesting scene where he kidnaps a guy in this kind of high-class, swanky party, and he, with his eyes, he scans this guy's face to impersonate him, and then he looks in the mirror, and then he realizes that something's wrong, and because he also scanned the duct tape on his captive's mouth. So the duct tape. So little things like that. It's a very good comic for newbies. 5 issues are out now, written by Kevin Smith, filmmaker. And, that was quite surprising. So I enjoyed that one. It's interesting that he took the time to actually set up the characters and whatnot first before just getting into all the bionic action.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Best one-shot or original graphic novel.
Yeah, we're drawing to the home stretch of the awards ceremony. There's no prizes except for the pride of winning and hearing your name on the internet. Now, my selection here, and there were quite a few good original graphic novels this year. And my favorite original graphic novel I'm going to be giving as best overall comics. So I figured for best one-shot or IGN, I'd recognize something else, if you know what I mean, like share it around. And for me, it's a comic called I Will Bite You by Joseph Lambert, and that's come out through Secret Acres Press. Now, it's 130-page, sort of small-format original graphic novel, and it's a series of short stories, most of which are pretty close to wordless. But what it does is it captures the kind of schizophrenic and wild and selfish nature of children and teen emotions on the page through these really intense, dreamlike stories. So what he does very well is he very creative use of comic space and storytelling. I mean, in one story, a trio of faceless monsters can physically manipulate the speech bubbles of other people. So to if someone screams help, they break the letters and make them just scream something else so no one can come to save them, that kind of thing.
Awesome.
And in the most striking story in the book, a pair of if you break it down, it's all it's about is a pair of brothers who become estranged. But the way it's presented is monstrous and psychedelic. The older brother first eats his dad, and then, in a kind of symbolic way, I guess, first he eats his words, his speech bubbles, then his dad, and then he starts devouring the whole world. And the point is they become so different. They have nothing else in common, but it's, in these kind of little abstract ways, he tells these stories, which are like, yeah, I can relate to that, even though it's this wild and crazy story. So it's very joyful, inventive, and abstract. But for me, it really appeals because it's so controlled but very raw. And another aspect of it, which is woefully underrepresented in most comics these days, is the typography and the lettering design. And it's some of the best I've seen in a very long time in how words and the letters on the page interact with the art and the comic. It's more than anything I've read. You know how people talk about comics is words and pictures together. This is a perfect synergy of those two things. So if you're a fan of beautifully illustrated indie black and white art with kind of not, I don't want to say, he doesn't have the self-indulgent, I'm a shitty artist approach of a lot of independent artists, if you know what I mean. His craft is amazing. And this for me is one of my faves of the year. I Will Bite You, Joseph Lambert.
That sounds familiar. I think when it first came out, I was like, should I get this or should I not?
I'd recommend it for you. The cover has this picture of a smiling yellow moon on it. And you can go to his website, Joseph Lambert's website, and he has quite a few free comics on there for you to read and just get a taste of his work. So I would recommend anyone and everyone do that because for me, I think his website's called Submarine. There you go. Check that out.
Cool.
What's yours, Chris?
Tale of Sand, just published, actually, by Archaea. It's based on an unproduced screenplay by Jim Henson. Jim Henson, obviously, we know Sesame Street, Muppets, Fraggle Rock, Labyrinth, Storyteller TV series.
Dark Crystal.
So it's based on a Dark Crystal. Based on a screenplay by him and Jerry Jewell. They actually did, like, three different drafts of this screenplay between 1967 and 1974, and it's actually just recently uncovered by one of the archivists at the Henson Company. It's obviously still around and run by his children. So I don't know if you've read this or seen previews of it, but I picked it because it's memorable, and it's one of those comics, much like you with Jack Ellis, that is something that only comics can get away with. I have no idea how they would have made a movie of this anyway.
Yeah.
And they did say that when they shopped it around, well, obviously every film company said, no thanks, it's just too wildly imaginative and just out there.
You know,
I think you could have made a comic of it back.
Yeah. See, I reckon Terry Gilliam could do it.
Yes, true.
He can do anything.
I'd like to see his Watchmen, actually.
Oh, I'm so bummed I haven't read this comic. I was really looking forward to it. Now you're just going to have to rub it in my face. Tell me how amazing it is.
I mean, there's not much of a spoiler alert because, again, it's very kind of experimental. It's largely silent. It's got an unnamed protagonist who's basically just running through the American Midwest. He has no idea what he's doing. It looks like it's either set in the 60s or 70s, perhaps. He's basically just selling his way from his townsfolk. And in his knapsack, he's got like a record. He's got this huge key. He's got a map. Mm-hmm. And then he basically just finds, it's almost like he's running through history. He finds like this outhouse toilet and he goes in there and it opens. Oh, hi, hello, welcome to the restaurant, you know. And then he sees like this mirage and this bikini girl by the porch. He goes, oh, you know, don't go in the porch, too salty, and the shark's in there. And he gets chased by this goatee devil looking guy who uses a cement truck to pour his martini. You can't describe what it is. It's like an acid trip, but it's not as kind of intense as that. It's very kind of whimsical, I guess, is the best way to describe it. The artist is Raymer Perez, and it's very kind of he again, like Mike Huddleston, he switches between kind of watercolor, pen and ink, kind of duotone, and it's basically just got this kind of Looney Tunes madcap vibe about it. You know, there's always something in motion. He's always running. If you see it, again, it just looks beautifully in paper form. So just, again, it's an original graphic novel that you just hand to someone. And it's almost like a picture book, I guess, because there's very little dialogue, but it's a beautiful-looking book, Madden. And as I said, just something that only comics can do, just in the scale and in the sense that it's kind of overlapping the way he uses panels. Look, I'll try and put a link to a preview because that's the best way to look at it and to describe it. But, yeah, Tale of Sand, out now by Arkaya, and Arkaya have just got a wonderful, well-deserved reputation of doing some wonderful books. They've also recently published The Storyteller, also based on the Jim Henson TV series. So that's an original graphic novel that Arkaya have also released, but I have not read yet.
Excellent. Good choices. Good choices, Chris. Yes. I'm proud of you. No, I'm joking. I don't mean to be condescending. No, that's cool. That's one I've been like, I want that. All right. Finally, the big one. Best overall comic.
So, no surprise for me.
Okay, I'm happy for you to go first. What have you got?
Is it the
new DC 52?
It would definitely be Who is Jack Ellis? Simply because the reasons we mentioned above, you know, before, it's got this great partnership between script and art.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a comic,
yeah,
I think it's something that could be adapted into film, but it wouldn't have quite the same panache. Written by Nathan Edmondson, art by Tonki Zonjic. There's not much more to say about this that hasn't been said.
Mm.
But, yeah, hopefully more will come. And this was, I've known Nathan Edmondson's work for a while. I've been a fan of his work, and it's great to see him doing something on a mainstream title as he is with Grifter, which is also good. But, yeah, Who is Jack Ellis? A great high concept, and one of those high concepts that could easily fail, you know. Yes. Like, oh, that sounds awesome, but it could not live up to the hype. But thankfully, Who is Jack Ellis does. Only 5 issues so far. Please, Edmondson and Zonjic and Image Comics,
That's a great selection. I mean, it absolutely deserves that kind of praise because it does capture the kind of energy of a great action story with a mystery and a twist and some great a great pair of characters really who rule the show and get the most, I guess, page time. And the way the story's doled out to you keeps you wanting to come back to each issue. It's just a great comic as a comic. And as you mentioned, high concept, being able to fall flat on its face, there was a couple this year which I felt were very high concept and were disasters.
Yeah.
And maybe we can talk about those in a supplementary episode because I've got one in mind. Maybe you'll agree with me, maybe you won't, but I'll save it for later. My overall favorite comic best overall comic this year is Big Questions by Anders Nilsson. Yes.
Yep.
Now, this book is fantastic. It's a huge tome about, I think it's 600 pages. It's about the same size as Habibian. That's about 600, surely.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's several kind of entwining stories about these finches who live in this very sparse field. And their lives and their relationships are affected first by this mysterious arrival of what is actually a bomb, but they think is an egg. And then the crash landing of a jet plane into the house owned by an old woman and her mentally handicapped son, who also live next to the birds. And it's, as a comic, it's very sparsely illustrated, the use of white space and so forth. But the way... Even the Finches all really look the same as each other, except towards the end of the story where some of them are injured, I guess. The way they're characterized is so strong, and the way they talk compared to each other and each to each, it's so... There's never a moment where you... Even though you're looking at a page of 12 identical Finches, you know exactly who's talking to who. And it takes a lot of skill as a writer to pull that sort of feat off, you know. But it's as a story, it's wonderfully ironic. The birds read this great mystic significance into the event of this plane crashing, which they think is a giant bird. And when the crashed pilot breaks out of the cockpit, they think he's the Messiah, like he's hatched from the great bird. And they become dangerously protective of it and him. And there's these concurrent plots of characters who don't agree with what's happening and who do. And there's a Finch who's being nursed back to health by a snake, which already is kind of strange. And that Finch descends into the underworld to find his lost wife. There's a subplot with the crows, and that which actually leads to, for me, one of the most exciting and... exciting action sequences of any book of the year, where it's just a trio of Finches having to face off against a trio of crows, because the stakes are just so high and they're just so horribly outmatched. It's one of those kind of gut-wrenching scenes where, because you care a lot about the characters, you're like, oh, God, what? But, and then the way the story wraps up and all these different character subplots meet together is just beautiful. And the fact that it came about organically, I should mention, this book was written over the course of 15 years. It came out originally as mini comics, but the last batch of them came out as the book. So for me, it's an overall comic, I guess. But over that period, I mean, and as he's had two fiancés, the first of which actually passed away from cancer, and you can pick up on that in the story. There's one divorce, he's moved house several times, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, his life changes, and over that long course of writing a comic, you can see how someone's life sort of seeps into it. And it's great that it's free-flowing, it's from the subconscious, utterly unpredictable completely. And it's just a wonderful piece of organic storytelling. And you know when people talk about comics being modern myth-making?
Yes.
Usually I call bullshit on that. This for me is a case where it absolutely applies. There's something mythic about this story, about these Finches in a field, told very sparsely and with wonderful characters. And it's more truthful and of a writer, you know, getting to know them, of anything I've read this year, and without being pretentious as a comic, which is a very tricky feat to pull off, which, I mean, There's a couple you and I have both read this year, and maybe we'll leave our honorary mentions for our supplementary episode, but there's a few which I thought were maybe a tad full of pretension, and for me, this is absolutely not. I'd recommend this to anyone. It's very funny, too. I forgot to mention that. There's so many laugh-out-loud moments in this. This is a fantastic long comic work, and so few good long comics come out that I just have to heap steaming piles of praise onto this comic. Big Questions, Anders Nielsen. Check it
out.
Excellent. Cool.
Whew, that's a lot of good stuff in there.
Oh, for sure. Thanks for sharing this awards ceremony with me, Chris, and another fantastic year of the Exosequential podcast.
It's been a pleasure and an honor to serve beside you, sir.
Captain. yes, you are my... No, you're more of a Picard. I'm more of the Riker.
Is that because I'm going bald?
Possibly.
And you've got a beard?
I have a beard.
And a woman?
Worf's definitely more of a man than he is. Hey, that's off topic. How did that happen?
So that was our best of 2011. Let us know on Facebook. Check us out if you agree or disagree, or, you know, what's... I mean, obviously, we can't read everything, even though we'd like to.
And there's a few we've read which maybe we just didn't feel like giving a prize to. And I know it made everyone else's list, and some things we saw, that shouldn't be on a list of books of 2011 to begin with. So I'm just... I'm telling off the people who are hypothetically angry at us for whatever reason. Preemptively.
You're defensive even before any accusations have been slung our way. You can email the show, chris@exosequential.com. That's Chris with a K. My blog is Comic Book Jesus, and hopefully we'll manage to squeeze out another show in the coming weeks. But we are going to take a hiatus of sorts as my wonderful partner in crime goes to Melbourne with his lovely girlfriend and makes a new life for himself. But nevertheless, the show will continue. So if we are off the air for a couple of weeks, then it's a good time to catch up on all previous episodes that perhaps you've missed, because we know people kind of don't listen to it every week that they come out necessarily. So perhaps a few people out there can play catch up. But yeah, we will definitely be coming back. Right, Maladdin? I want you to promise me.
No, yeah, the show is not done. The show is still going, folks. I still love it every week, and I've had a fun year. There'll be lots more to come, and a huge thanks. I mean, I can't mention it enough. A huge thanks to everyone who's been listening to the show and following it, or even if you're just someone who pops in every now and then to check on us. It's cool that you find us interesting enough to listen to. And that makes all the difference. Huge, big shout outs to everyone on the Facebook, Extra Sequential Facebook site, everyone who's joined in on the competitions and the chats we've had there. I should even throw a shout out to our, friendly neighbor podcasts, the C-List podcast, which I think is on a brief hiatus as well. The Sequel Cast, another great podcast. And I just want to throw out, a huge thank you to the Battleship Pretension podcast. Even though they probably won't ever listen to this, they're part of what got me excited about doing this. So,
excellent.
Thanks to everyone who's followed us, and special thanks to Chris.
Good. So, it's been a pleasure.
Listen, in a couple of weeks' time, we'll have a little supplementary episode talking about some of the runners up, the books which didn't quite make it, as well as the ones which we're probably disappointed by this year, or whatever was just dismal. A recap of the year. You can look forward to that over your Christmassy break.
And have a good Christmas, everyone. And hopefully also let us know if you got some good comics or managed to purchase some comics that we discussed last week that would be a good gift for newbies. Let us know if that worked this Christmas.
Thanks again, everyone. See you, and have a merry non-denominational holiday fun fest.
And New Year.
See you, Chris.
Bye, Milan. Bye, all.